The title of my paper is Who is the Sovereign Individual? Nietzsche on Freedom. The paper should run about 50 minutes, so that should leave us a good amount for discussion. So, most readers of Nietzsche's On the Genealogy of Morality over the last century would, one suspects, be astonished to discover the prominence recent scholarship has given to the enigmatic figure of the sovereign individual, who appears just once in section 2 of the second essay, The Genealogy, and never appears again in the genealogy or indeed anywhere else in the corpus. Yet according to Keith Ansel Pearson, for example, and I quote, the overriding aim of the genealogy of morals is to show that what Kant and the modern liberal tradition of moral and political philosophy, moral and political thought, simply take for granted, the sovereign individual in possession of a free will and conscience, is in reality the product of a specific historical labor of culture or civilization, end of the quote. If this were really the overriding aim of the genealogy, one would have expected Nietzsche to be a bit clearer about it and to have more to say about this sovereign individual. Ansel Pearson's claim is, to be sure, rather extreme, but his is nonetheless on a recognizable continuum with other assessments. John Richardson, for example, describes section 2 of the second essay as, quote, a dramatic statement of Nietzsche's positive view of freedom. For Peter Pollner, the sovereign individual gives expression to, quote, the constitutive conditions of full-fledged autonomous rather than heteronomous selfhood. Ken James thinks the sovereign individual illuminates, quote, genuine agency, the question, what is it to be a self capable of acting? Indeed, and I quote again, what exactly it is to be a genuine self. So who is this sovereign individual of the second essay? And what does he have to do with Nietzsche's conceptions of free will, freedom, or the self? I shall argue for what would have been at one time a fairly unsurprising view, namely that first, Nietzsche denies that people ever act freely and that they are ever morally responsible for anything they do. Second, that the figure of the sovereign individual in no way supports a denial of this first point. And third, that Nietzsche engages in what Charles Stevenson, in his famous 1938 paper on persuasive definitions, Nietzsche engages in what Stevenson would have called a persuasive definition of the language of freedom and free will, radically revising the content of those concepts, but in a way that aims to capitalize on their positive emotive valence and authority for his readers. More precisely, I aim to show that the image of the sovereign individual is in fact consistent with the reading of Nietzsche as a kind of fatalist, which I have defended at length elsewhere. On the fatalist reading, Nietzsche thinks that persons have certain essential psychological and physiological traits over which they have no autonomous control, and which, together perhaps with environmental influences like values, cause and determine their life trajectories. In particular, Nietzsche thinks that the feeling of free will is at bottom an epiphenomenon of a process in which conscious thoughts that are consistent with and temporally proximate to succeeding actions are misinterpreted as causal, when in fact both the thoughts and the actions themselves are causally determined by non-conscious, perhaps neurophysical aspects of the person. The upshot is that our actions are neither causa sui nor caused by any conscious state with which we might identify, and so our actions cannot bear ascriptions of responsibility, that is, ascriptions of justified praise and blame. To show that the image of the sovereign individual squares with Nietzsche's fatalism, I distinguish in what follows between two different deflationary readings of the passage. On one such reading, the figure of the sovereign individual is wholly ironic, a mocking of the petite bourgeois who thinks his petty commercial undertakings, his ability to make promises and remember his debts, are the highest fruit of creation. On another deflationary reading, the sovereign individual does indeed represent an ideal of the self, one marked by a kind of self-mastery foreign to less coherent selves whose momentary impulses pull them this way and that. But such a self and its self-mastery is, in Nietzschean terms, a fortuitous natural artifact, a bit of fate, not an autonomous achievement for which anyone could be responsible. To associate this ideal of the self with the language of freedom and free will is an exercise in persuasive definition by Nietzsche, a rhetorical skill at which he was often the master. I am inclined to think the second reading is probably, the second deflationary reading is probably the correct one, though the somewhat ridiculously hyperbolic presentation of the sovereign individual to which we return will make the first reading attractive in some ways. But either reading allows us to understand how and why Nietzsche, the fatalist and arch-skeptic about free will, would have created the figure of the sovereign individual. So we do well to begin by reminding ourselves of what Nietzsche actually says about free will and responsibility in the many passages from many different books that span his entire philosophical career that must inform any interpretation of the section on the sovereign individual. Even if we put to one side Human All Too Human, a work of the late 1870s, in which Nietzsche clearly accepted a straightforwardly incompatibilist picture, in which the determinism of our universe rules out free will and moral responsibility, evidence of Nietzsche's skepticism about freedom and responsibility remains plentiful in his mature corpus of the 1880s. Thus, at the start of the decade, in Daybreak, he writes, and this is section 128, "Do I have to add that the wise Oedipus was right, that we really are not responsible for our dreams, but just as little for our waking life? And that the doctrine of freedom of will has human pride and feeling of power for its father and mother." So belief in freedom of the will is to be explained by the ulterior motivations we have for accepting it, not by its reality. We are as little responsible for what we do in real life as what we do in our dreams. It is hard to imagine a more bracing denial of freedom and responsibility. The same themes are sounded in one of his very last works, The Antichrist. This is from section 14. "Formerly man was given a free will as his dowry from a higher order. Today we have taken his will away altogether in the sense that we no longer admit the will as a faculty. The old word will now serves only to denote a resultant, a kind of individual reaction which follows necessarily upon a number of partly contradictory, partly harmonious stimuli. The will no longer acts or moves." Denial of the causality of the will, or more precisely what we experience as will, is central to Nietzsche's skepticism about free will, and also explains why he frequently denies unfree will as well. What we experience as will does not in fact cause our actions, so the causal determination of freedom of this will is irrelevant. In Daybreak, he writes, this is section 124, "We laugh at him who steps out of his room at the moment when the sun steps out of its room, and then says, 'I will that the sun shall rise,' and at him who cannot stop a wheel and says, 'I will that it shall roll,' and at him who is thrown down in wrestling and says, 'Here I lie, but I will lie here.' But all laughter aside, are we ourselves ever acting any differently whenever we employ the expression, 'I will'? If the faculty of the will no longer acts or moves, as the Antichrist passage puts it, if it is no longer causal, then there remains no conceptual space for the compatibilist idea that the right kind of causal determination of the will is compatible with responsibility for our actions. If, as Zarathustra puts it, thought is one thing, the deed is another, and the image of the deed still another, the wheel of causality does not roll between them, which is a pithy statement of the point of the Daybreak passage I just quoted, then there is no room for moral responsibility. I may well identify with my thoughts or my will, but if they do not cause my actions, how could I possibly be responsible for them? In the central discussion of free will and responsibility in the genealogy, Nietzsche writes, "For just as common people separate the lightning from its flesh, and take the latter to be a deed, something performed by a subject called lightning, so popular morality also separates strength from the expressions of strength, as if there were an indifferent substrate behind the strong person which had the freedom to manifest strength or not. But there is no such substrate. The suppressed, hiddenly glowing affects of revenge and hate exploit this belief, the belief in a subject or substrate, and basically even uphold no other belief more ardently than this one, that the strong are free to be weak and the birds of prey are free to be lambs. They thereby gain for themselves the right to hold the bird of prey accountable. The weak need the belief in a neutral subject with free choice out of an instinct of self-preservation, self-affirmation, in which every lie is sanctified. That's section 13 of the first essay. The will that was denied as a faculty in the other passages is now here, I take it, dubbed the substrate that stands behind the act and chooses to perform it or not. But there is no such faculty, whether we call it will or substrate, choosing to manifest strength or weakness. There just is the doing, no doer who bears the responsibility for it. The discussion of the four great errors in the Twilight of the Idols is to the same effect. As he concludes that chapter, quote, today we no longer have any pity for the concept of free will. We know only too well what it really is, the foulest of all theologians' artifices aimed at making mankind responsible in their sense. The doctrine of the will has been invented essentially for the purpose of punishment, that is, because one wanted to impute guilt. So once again, denial that the will is a causal faculty, which is the central argument of this chapter of Twilight, is juxtaposed with a psychological explanation for why people would nonetheless be motivated to believe in freedom and responsibility. Once we abandon this error of free will, that's what Nietzsche calls it, we should in turn abandon the reactive concepts whose intelligibility depends on it, concepts like guilt. Zarathustra well describes the required revision to our thinking about freedom and responsibility that results. This is from the section on the pale criminal. Enemy, you shall say, but not villain. Sick, you shall say, but not scoundrel. Fool, you shall say, but not sinner. The abandoned concepts, that of villain, scoundrel, and sinner, are all ones that require freedom and responsibility that would license blame, while the substitute concepts, enemy, sick, and fool, merely describe a person's condition or character, without supposing anything about the agent's responsibility for being in that condition or having that character. Any account of what is going on in the passage on the sovereign individual must show how it is consistent with these pervasive themes in the Nietzschean corpus. So let's turn now to the sovereign individual passage. Nietzsche begins the second essay in the genealogy with a characteristically naturalistic question: how to breed an animal which is able to make and honor a promise. The assumptions underlying this question are twofold. First, and most obviously, human beings are certain kinds of animals. And second, as with other animals, one explains what they do, for example, promise breeding, not by appeal to their exercise of some capacity for autonomous choice and decision, but in terms of the causal mechanisms, such as breeding, acting upon them, which yield certain steady behavioral dispositions. Nietzsche identifies two preconditions for the behavioral disposition at issue here, namely promise-making. First, regularity of behavior, and second, reliable memory. Regularity is necessary because a promise-maker must be, as Nietzsche puts it, answerable for his own future, and one cannot be answerable for a future that is utterly unpredictable. Memory is essential for the obvious reason that only someone who can remember his promises can possibly honor them. Two factors are singled out by Nietzsche as formative for the human animal in its development of regular behavior and a memory. One he calls the morality of custom, and the other is the role of pain in mnemonics. With, quote, the help of the morality of custom and the social straitjacket, man was made truly predictable. That's from section 2 of the second essay. Nietzsche here alludes to his own earlier discussion in Daybreak, which, drawing on the etymological connection between Sittlichkeit, morality, and Sitte, custom, advanced the plausible hypothesis that customs constituted the first morality, that traditional ways of acting played the same role during early human life that rarefied and lofty moral codes, rules, and principles play today, that they provided criteria for moral right and wrong. In this earlier discussion, however, Nietzsche, that is the Daybreak discussion, Nietzsche's goal was a certain naturalization of the implausible Kantian account of moral motivation as a matter of reverence for the moral law. Nietzsche proposes instead that it is obedience to tradition and fear of the consequences of deviation from tradition that really explains moral motivation. By the time he writes the genealogy, Nietzsche is now more interested in the role of custom, the social straitjacket, as he calls it, in making humans truly predictable, that is, regular in their behavior. This development eventually yields the individual with a conscience, whom Nietzsche refers to variously as a sovereign or autonomous individual. Here's the crucial passage, which I'm going to quote at some length. With the help of the morality of custom and the social straitjacket, man was made truly predictable. Let us place ourselves, on the other hand, at the end of this immense process where the tree actually bears fruit, where society and its morality of custom reveal what they were simply the means to. We then find the sovereign individual as the ripest fruit on its tree, like only to itself, having freed itself from the morality of custom, an autonomous, super-ethical individual, because autonomous and ethical are mutually exclusive. In short, we find a man with his own independent, durable will who has the right to make a promise and has a proud consciousness quivering in every muscle of what he has finally achieved and incorporated, an actual awareness of power and freedom, a feeling that man in general has reached completion. This man who is now free and who really does have the right to make a promise, this master of the free will, this sovereign, how could he remain ignorant of his superiority over everybody who does not have the right to make a promise or answer for himself? How much trust, fear, and respect he arouses. He merits all three. And how could he, with his self-mastery, not realize that he has necessarily been given mastery over circumstances, over nature, and over all creatures with a less durable and reliable will? The free man, now he puts free in quotes, the free man, the possessor of a durable, unbreakable will, thus has his own standard of value. In the possession of such a will, viewing others from his own standpoint, he respects or despises. And just as he will necessarily respect his peers, the strong and the reliable, those with the right to give their word, that is, everyone who makes promises like a sovereign, ponderously, seldom, slowly, and is sparing with his trust, who confers an honor when he places his trust, who gives his word as something which can be relied on because he is strong enough to remain upright in the face of mishap or even in the face of fate. So he will necessarily be ready to kick the febrile whippets who make a promise when they have no right to do so, and will save the rod for the liar who breaks his word in the very moment it passes his lips. The proud realization of the extraordinary privilege of responsibility, the awareness of this rare freedom and power over himself and his destiny, has penetrated him to the depths and become an instinct, his dominant instinct. What will he call his dominant instinct, assuming that he needs a word for it? No doubt about the answer. This sovereign man calls it his conscience. So let us start at the beginning. The sovereign individual is said to be the fruit of the long tradition of the morality of custom. But the tree bears this fruit at the point when the morality of custom is left behind. This individual is autonomous or super-ethical, uber-sittlich, in the quite precise sense of being no longer bound by the morality of custom, the morality of sitta. He is the perfected animal, the one so perfected by the breeding of the morality of custom that he no longer needs the discipline of sitta to perform his trick, as it were. And what exactly is the trick of this well-trained animal? Surely it bears emphasizing that he is described as having one and only one skill. He can actually make and keep a promise. And why can he do that? Because he can remember that he made it, and his behavior is sufficiently regular and predictable that others will actually act based on his promises. This might explain why Nietzsche gives this self-important animal, the so-called sovereign individual, a suitably ridiculous and pompous name. He refers to him in the original as the souverain, French, souverain individual, a mix of French and perhaps Latin. Right? There's also obviously a German individual, meaning literally something like a sovereign atom. A phrase he never uses again anywhere in the corpus, and he never uses any alternative formulation of that same phrase anywhere in the corpus. We can talk about that during discussion. And the conscience of this self-important creature, as Nietzsche makes clear, consists in nothing more than the ability to remember his debts. One might then be tempted to conclude that this whole passage is little more than a parody of the contemporary bourgeois who thinks that he has achieved something unique, something individual, just because he is steady enough to make a promise and honor it. Capitalism, as everyone knows, destroys customary practices. Yet after their demise, there remains the upright bourgeois who can enter a contract and remember his legal obligations, no less. The modern bourgeois, in short, fancies himself the highest fruit of creation simply because he can remember his business deals. Now, there is admittedly more to this passage than what we've called attention to so far. Indeed, in a recent vigorous challenge to deflationary readings of the passage, including my own and earlier work, Thomas Miles has argued, and this is in the most recent International Studies in Philosophy, I think it's year 2007, but in keeping with tradition, it only just came out a month or two ago. Thomas Miles has argued that self-mastery is central to the image of the sovereign individual, and that, and under Miles, this self-mastery consists of a self-affirming conscience that guides this sovereign individual to take on great tasks and fulfill his commitments to them. Now, as we've already noted, the only great task concretely on offer by Nietzsche is that the sovereign individual can make a promise and keep it. This is not nothing, to be sure, but it seems prima facie hard to square with the overblown rhetoric of section 2, to which Miles calls attention. For example, I'll read again a portion of the passage. The proud realization of the extraordinary privilege of responsibility, the awareness of this rare freedom and power over himself and his fate, has penetrated him to the depths and become an instinct, his dominant instinct. What will he call his dominant instinct, assuming that he needs a word for it? No doubt about the answer, this sovereign man calls it his conscience. But Nietzsche, as we have already seen, denies, and not just once, that anyone has, quote, freedom and power over himself and his fate, or that anyone has, as the second essay also claims, mastery over circumstances. The conclusion of the four great errors from Twilight of the Idols is as clear as any passage in Nietzsche on the subject, and I quote, no one gives people their qualities, not God or society's parents or ancestors, not even people themselves. Nobody is responsible for people existing in the first place, or for the state or circumstances or environment they are in. That means, of course, that the sovereign individual whose privilege of responsibility extends to himself and his fate, indeed to his circumstances, is delusional, at least if he really believes any of this. He may well feel responsible, but his feeling is unwarranted. Now, that conclusion is, of course, exactly what one should expect from Nietzsche's most important discussion of the phenomenon of self-mastery, the trait that Miles emphasizes is attributed to the sovereign individual. And this is the discussion from Daybreak, a passage to which I have called attention before as striking evidence of Nietzsche's fatalism. In section 109 of Daybreak, Nietzsche canvasses six different ways of combating the vehemence of a drive. For example, by avoiding opportunities for gratification of the drive, thus weakening it over time, or by learning to associate painful thoughts with the drive so that its satisfaction no longer has a positive valence. More significantly, Nietzsche is also concerned in this passage to answer the question as to the ultimate motive for self-mastery. And he explains it as follows, and I quote, that one wants to combat the vehemence of a drive at all, however, does not stand within our own power. Nor does the choice of any particular method, nor does the success or failure of this method. What is clearly the case is that in this entire procedure, our intellect is only the blind instrument of another drive, which is a rival of the drive whose vehemence is tormenting us. While we believe we are complaining about the vehemence of a drive, at bottom it is one drive which is complaining about the other. That is to say, for us to become aware that we are suffering from the vehemence of a drive presupposes the existence of another equally vehement or even more vehement drive, and that a struggle is in prospect in which our intellect is going to have to take sides. Now, even if the intellect must take sides, there is no suggestion in this passage that the intellect determines which side prevails. To the contrary, the intellect is, on Nietzsche's picture, the mere blind instrument of another drive. Thus, the fact that one masters oneself is not a product of autonomous choice by the person, but rather an effect of the underlying psychological facts characteristic of that person, namely which of his various drives happen to be the strongest. There is, as it were, no self in self-mastery. That is, no conscious or free self who contributes anything to the process. Self-mastery is merely an effect of the interplay of certain drives over which the conscious self exercises no control, though it may, as it were, root for one side or the other. The conscious self and its body is simply an arena in which the struggle of drives is played out. How they play out determines what he believes, what he values, what he becomes. But qua conscious self or agent, the person takes no active part in the process. To be sure, some higher types of people, Goethe's and Nietzsche's, for example, exemplify a unified hierarchy of drives that Nietzsche occasionally dubs as exemplars of freedom. We'll return to that below. But we do not honor Nietzsche's admonition to read him free of moral prejudices if we then try to reconstruct this as a moral ideal of autonomy and responsibility. In sum, we can agree with the emphasis of Miles on the self-mastery, characteristic of the sovereign individual, and still acknowledge that given Nietzsche's conception of self-mastery, it is wholly compatible with his denial of free will and moral responsibility in so many other passages. So how is this account of the sovereign individual passage, which shows it to be of a piece with his fatalistic skepticism about freedom and responsibility, to be reconciled with what Nietzsche says elsewhere in his work when he talks of freedom and free will? Polner suggests that one important positive view of freedom in Nietzsche represents it as a kind of substantive ideal. And actually, these papers by Polner, Richardson, and Jeames that I'm referring to are all in the Jeames and May Nietzsche on Freedom and Autonomy volume, which is back there for those who are interested. So Polner suggests one view is as a freedom as a kind of substantive ideal. As Polner describes it, and I quote, "Freedom as a substantive ideal is what seems to be at stake in many of those remarks where Nietzsche expresses admiration for people who, as he sees them, have succeeded in integrating an unusually great multiplicity of drives and a value of commitments into a long-lasting, coherent whole." That's Polner's characterization. I think this is the best reading of what Ken Jeames has recently been arguing as well. When he speaks of Nietzsche as wanting to understand genuine agency and wanting to change, quote, his preferred readers from being mere conduit points of a vast array of conflicting inherited drives into genuinely unified beings, that's Jeames, I take him to see Nietzsche as presenting us with an ideal of agency, one involving a kind of unity of the drives. Perhaps the sovereign individual is meant to represent such an ideal as well, albeit a bit opaquely. Yet the ideal itself does seem to be a recognizably Nietzschean one. The question, however, naturally arises why this ideal should be associated with freedom, or free will, or autonomy. Why not just say that Nietzsche's ideal agent has a certain pattern of coherent drives or dispositions, the pattern to be specified, of course, and leave it at that? Freedom is, after all, a promiscuous concept. In ordinary language, we say that someone just released from prison is a free man, and we also say that someone who shuns conventional expectations about careers or styles of dress or other social norms is a free spirit. But being unconstrained by physical limits, as in prison walls, or social conventions, as in expectations about careers or appearance, does not raise philosophically interesting points about freedom or human agency, for Nietzsche or for anyone else. We need much more evidence than an occasional use of the term freedom to conclude that Nietzsche has a philosophically important positive conception of freedom or free will. Readers of Nietzsche know that he often employs familiar concepts in revisionary or highly deflationary senses, such is ultimately the case with Nietzsche's view of freedom and free will. I agree with Jeames and Polner that Nietzsche sometimes, though not nearly as often as they think, if you look at the passages in some detail, that Nietzsche sometimes associates the language of freedom with certain kinds of persons, agents whose psychic economy has a certain kind of coherence or harmony. But in so doing, he is engaged in what Charles Stevenson would have called the persuasive definition of freedom. He wants to radically revise the content of freedom while exploiting the positive balance that the traditional concept has for his readers. This is because Nietzsche recognizes that to really transform the consciousness of his preferred readers, he must reach them at an emotional, even subconscious level. And one way to do so is to associate Nietzschean ideals with values in which his readers are already emotionally invested. And as Nietzsche notes in The Gay Science, values are among the most powerful levers in the involved mechanisms of our actions. Thus, by associating an ideal of the person with the evaluatively, that is emotionally, laden ideal of freedom and free will, which his readers will already accept, Nietzsche increases the likelihood that he can activate the causal levers of at least some of these readers that will lead them towards this new ideal. or I should say cause them, to realize this new ideal. Yet from a purely descriptive point of view, he might just as well have called his new ideal agents unified or causally coherent agents, not quite as catchy, since his picture really has nothing to do with freedom at all. Nietzsche's ideal unified agent is just a kind of natural artifact, one whose drives interact constructively rather than destructively. But with regard to his rhetorical aims, Nietzsche is shrewd to sometimes describe such natural artifacts as exemplars of freedom. Both James and Pohner, like other writers in this genre, rely on a very small number of passages to support what they claim is Nietzsche's positive account of freedom. I want to examine these passages with some care. I've already dealt with the second section of the second essay of the genealogy, since I think it will turn out that they do not generally bear the readings James and Pohner want to give them. Now, to be clear again, I'm not denying that Nietzsche highly values persons who, by natural fortuity, exhibit the kind of agency picked out, I take it, by James's notion of genuine agency and Pohner's notion of full personhood. But none of this has anything to do with any concept that the philosophical traditions have labeled freedom or free will. Well, what better place to start than with Twilight of the Idol, Skirmishes of an Untimely Man, section 38, which Nietzsche explicitly titles My Conception of Freedom. Here's how he introduces and explicates that concept, and I quote, "Liberal institutions cease to be liberal as soon as they are attained. Later on, there are no worse and no more thorough injurers of freedom than liberal institutions. Their effects are known well enough. They undermine the will to power. They level mountain and valley and call that morality. They make men small, cowardly, and hedonistic. Every time it is the herd animal that triumphs with them. Liberalism, in other words, herd animalization." Now, the introduction to his conception of freedom seems clear. One undermines freedom by making, quote, men small, cowardly, and hedonistic. Philosophical and religious traditions have had many views of freedom, to be sure, but I am not aware of any in which being big, brave, and indifferent to suffering loomed large. Yet that appears to be the concept of freedom Nietzsche invokes here. The passage continues. "These same liberal institutions produce different effects while they are still being fought for. Then they really promote freedom in a powerful way. On closer inspection, it is war that produces these effects, the war for liberal institutions. War educates freedom. For what is freedom? That one has the will to assume responsibility for oneself, that one maintains the distance which separates us, that one becomes more indifferent to difficulties, hardships, privation, even to life itself, that one is prepared to sacrifice human beings for one's cause, not excluding oneself. Freedom means that the manly instincts which delight in war and victory dominate over other instincts, for example, over those of happiness. The human being who has become free, and much more the spirit who has become free, spits on the contemptible type of well-being dreamed of by shopkeepers, Christians, cows, females, Englishmen, and other Democrats. The free man is a warrior. The Freimensch ist Krieger. And we're going to come back to that. So, assuming responsibility for oneself is, of course, not quite the same thing as actually being responsible for one's actions. The former is an attitude, a disposition, namely that of the warrior, we find out. There is no sense, ordinary or philosophical, in which freedom means pleasure in warfare. The warriors are, to be sure, usually thought to be big, brave, and indifferent to suffering. This is quite clearly, I think, persuasive definition in the sense Stevenson identified many decades ago. In section 41 of the same chapter from Twilight of the Idols, Nietzsche then describes the, quote, freedom which I do not mean, namely, and here's his explanation, abandonment to one's instincts. Today, the claim for independence and free development for laissez-aller is pressed most hotly by the very people for whom no reins would be too strict. That is a symptom of decadence. Our modern conception of freedom is one more proof of the degeneration of the instincts. So in other words, Nietzsche renounces one of the colloquial connotations of the idea of freedom, namely freedom from constraints. The point here is obviously of a piece with the concern in Beyond Good and Evil. This is section 188, where Nietzsche says, and I quote, "Everything there is or was of freedom, subtlety, boldness, dance, or masterly assurance on earth, whether in thinking itself, or in ruling, or in speaking and persuading, in artistic, just as in ethical practices, has only developed by virtue of the tyranny of such arbitrary laws. Every artist knows how far removed from this feeling of letting go laissez-aller, is from his most natural state, the free ordering, placing, disposing, and shaping in the moment of inspiration. He knows how strict and subtly he obeys thousands of laws at this very moment, laws that defy conceptual formulation precisely because of their hardness and determinateness. So freedom, in Nietzsche's sense, does not mean freedom from constraint, but its opposite, being subject to hard and determinate laws. Section 213 of Beyond Good and Evil continues this line of thought, and I quote again, "Artists are the ones who know only too well that their feeling of freedom, finesse, and authority, of creation, formation, and control, only reaches its apex when they have stopped doing anything voluntarily and instead do everything necessary. In short, they know that inside themselves, necessity and, quote, freedom of the will have become one." Notice that freedom of the will is placed in quotes by Nietzsche himself in this passage. It's not, after all, real freedom of the will, since it involves nothing voluntary, that's what he tells us, only action which is necessary. Actions bound, as he says in the earlier passage, by hard laws. These passages resonate in turn with the famous section 335 of The Gay Science, which appears to suggest that people can create themselves. Here is the bit of the passage emphasized by Polner and Miles in their exposition of Nietzsche's positive conception of freedom. And I quote, "We want to become who we are, human beings who are new, unique, incomparable, who give themselves laws, who create themselves." Yet this passage then continues as follows, and this is the continuation upon which most scholars are, alas, silent, but I am always vocal, and here it is. "To that end of creating ourselves, we must become the best learners and discoverers of everything that is lawful and necessary in the world. We must become physicists in order to be creators in this sense. While hitherto all valuations and ideals have been based on ignorance of physics, therefore long live physics." So creation in this sense is a very special sense indeed, for it presupposes the discovery of what is lawful and necessary as revealed by the physical sciences. And this, of course, recalls the earlier theme about the equivalence of freedom and necessity. In context, what Nietzsche has in mind becomes clearer, for in the preceding part of section 335, he explains that while the particular cause of any action is indemonstrable, we do know that values are, quote, among the most powerful levers in the involved mechanisms of our actions. Thus, the task for the sciences is to discover the laws of cause and effect governing particular values and particular actions, a more refined version of the task that Nietzsche later calls for in the note at the end of the first essay of the genealogy, namely for the human sciences to examine the effects of different kinds of valuations on the good of the majority and the good of the minority, as he puts it there. So what textual evidence of Nietzsche's putative positive view of freedom remains? Section 348 of The Gay Science, which equates freedom of the will with freedom from the need for certainty, the need that drives people, Nietzsche says, to faith and fanaticism, obviously tells us nothing about agency or free will and is a wholly revisionary usage of the concept. There is, in addition, the openly revisionary account of freedom in the first chapter of Beyond Good and Evil, according to which, quote, "freedom of the will," puts in quotes, "that is the word for the multifaceted state of pleasure of one who commands, and at the same time identifies himself with the accomplished act of willing. As such, he enjoys the triumph over resistances, but thinks of himself that it was his will alone that truly overcame the resistance." Now, as I've argued elsewhere, the analysis of the will and freedom in this chapter is fully of a piece with, the first chapter of Beyond Good and Evil, is fully of a piece with his general denial of free will and moral responsibility. That leaves us then with just two passages in the published corpus that interpreters of his positive theory of freedom point towards. In one passage, section 10 of the third essay of the genealogy, in which Nietzsche considers how the ascetic ideal validates the conditions under which philosophers can flourish, he concludes by noting that even in the modern world, the obstacles to being a philosopher remain great. I quote, "Is there even now enough pride, daring, courage, self-confidence, will of spirit, will to take responsibility, freedom of will," puts in italics, "for the philosopher on earth to be really possible?" This passing reference to freedom of will is revealing, since it makes clear that Nietzsche views it as interchangeable with dispositions of character like pride and courage and self-confidence, all traits one can possess without being responsible for having them, without, in short, having developed them in any way freely. That brings us to perhaps the most interesting Nietzschean passage mentioning freedom, from chapter 8 of Twilight of the Idols, a passage on Goethe. It bears quoting at some length. This is section 49. Goethe, not a German event, but a European one, a magnificent attempt to overcome the 18th century by returning to nature, by coming towards the naturalness of the Renaissance, a type of self-overcoming on the part of that century. He made use of history, science, antiquity, and Spinoza too, but above all, he made use of practical activity. He did not remove himself from life, he put himself squarely in the middle of it. He did not despair, and he took as much as he could on himself, to himself, in himself. What he wanted was totality. He fought against the separation of reason, sensibility, feeling, will, preached in the most forbiddingly scholastic way by Kant, Goethe's antipode. He disciplined himself to wholeness. He created himself. In the middle of an age inclined to unreality, Goethe was a convinced realist. He said yes to everything relating to him. His greatest experience was that of the most real thing that went by the name of Napoleon. Goethe conceived of a strong, highly educated, self-respecting human being, skilled in all things physical, and able to keep himself in check, who could dare to allow himself the entire expanse and wealth of naturalness, who is strong enough for this freedom. A spirit like this, who has become free, stands in the middle of the world with a cheerful and trusting fatalism, in the belief that everything is redeemed and affirmed in the whole. He does not negate anymore. But a belief like this is the highest of all possible beliefs. I have christened it with the name Dionysus. There are two striking motifs in this passage. First, the emphasis on an ideal of naturalism and realism, which is explicitly associated with Napoleon. And secondly, the equation of commitment to this ideal with freedom, but also an attitude of fatalism and ultimately Dionysus. So how are we to understand these motifs and their relation to each other? The immediately preceding section of Twilight, section 48, in fact concerns Napoleon and his, quote, high, free, even terrible nature and naturalness. Indeed, Napoleon is declared by Nietzsche to be a piece of return to nature, as I understand it, exactly the return Nietzsche also attributes to Goethe. If we understand the sense in which Napoleon returns to nature and exemplifies the natural, we will understand something about the meaning of freedom in the following section. Now, Napoleon's return to nature in section 48 is explicitly contrasted with Rousseau's conception of man's natural state, which Nietzsche deems the idealistic fantasies of the rabble, meaning in particular their doctrine of equality. No poison is more poisonous than this, says Nietzsche. And section 48 concludes that, quote, only one person perceived it, this event of the 18th century, correctly, with disgust, namely Goethe. Since this freedom for which Goethe is strong enough is equated with the entire expanse of and wealth of naturalness, of which Napoleon is the exemplar, it would seem to follow that the freedom of a Goethe is in part an acceptance of the reality of the natural inequality between people, and a renunciation of the Rousseauian illusions about what persons are like in a truly natural state. But Goethe's kind of freedom, his becoming free, as Nietzsche puts it, is also explicitly equated with an attitude of, quote, cheering and trusting fatalism, which in turn is equated with the Dionysian attitude that is clearly recognizable as amor fati, that is, acceptance and affirmation of the way things really are, rather than falling prey to the fantasies of the idealist and rabble rolled into one, namely Rousseau. To be free in this sense, then, is to be free of the wish that reality be other than it is, that is, unequal, terrible, and cruel, as Napoleon himself, of course, was. It is not, however, to be a free agent as conceived by Kant or Hume, or as far as I can tell, by any other major figure in the philosophical tradition. Nietzsche would rather persuade select readers to the fatalism of a Goethe by co-opting the language of freedom itself to commend to them an attitude that is premised on its denial in the most profound sense, a denial of the Enlightenment ideal that men through free will and their rational capacities can all become equal. Like the illiberal idea that der Freimensch is Krieger, that the free man is a warrior, or that to be free is to be big, brave, and indifferent to suffering, this key passage from Twilight persuasively redefines freedom in the service of Nietzschean values. In this case, the illiberal idea that to be truly free is to be not just reconciled to, but to affirm the essential inequality of persons. So to conclude, if Nietzsche really says so little that suggests he holds out the hope of a freedom or free will that would be recognizable to the philosophical tradition or common sense, if his skepticism about freedom and responsibility is so resolute, if what he actually says about freedom and free will is often so clearly revisionary, so plainly an exercise in persuasive definition that means to exploit his readers' antecedent prejudices on behalf of very different Nietzschean ideals, even quite illiberal ideals, then how are we to explain the recent scholarly consensus, if that is what it is, with which we began? It is, I fear, a manifestation of the fault against which Nietzsche often railed, and which we have seen so many times before in the Nietzsche literature, in Heidegger's transformation of Nietzsche into the last metaphysical philosopher, in Kaufman's rendering of him as a harmless secular humanist, in Nahemus's defanging of him as an aestheticist. In each case, I think the aim is to make Nietzsche less appalling to we delicate modern readers than he really is. For Nietzsche does not believe in freedom or responsibility. He does not think we exercise any meaningful control over our lives. He does not think that his revisionary sense of freedom, the long protracted will, as he puts it in the passage on the sovereign individual, is in reach of just anyone that anyone could choose to have. Indeed, in the important passage from Twilight with which we concluded, freedom is rather clearly invoked on behalf of Nietzsche's illiberal vision of the inescapable reality of human inequality. The resistance to these points in the recent scholarly literature, I conclude, reflects the continuing malign influence of moralizing readings of Nietzsche, of the failure to remember what he says about his conception of Renaissance virtue, namely that we understand it, that we should understand it and him, more aligned free. Thank you.